Welcome to the podcast, Entrepreneur Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time, a Kessler's Family production. In this episode, we are going to talk about Charleston, South Carolina, running for state senate and the South Carolina Gamecocks. Our guest today is Mark Heath, a sales VP at CasSource, a politician and a huge Gamecocks fan. Mark is an insurance agent and broker who is a native of the Lowcountry. He currently lives in Charleston, South Carolina. Mark came to CasSource 2 years ago. He made a transition from being an advisor at Merrill Lynch to selling life insurance with CasSource on the brokerage side of our business. Mark specializes in helping financial advisors grow their business. This Charleston native is proud to be in his hometown, helping area families and businesses better their community. Mark brings perspectives of someone with a financial planning background and an understanding of the political landscape. He's very much focused on his close relationships, including his family, friends, and clients, and he is determined to help the business he is a part of continue to grow, and we just love that about him. Let's get into it. Mark, welcome to the Entrepreneur Perspectives Podcast. How you doing
Thanks
today?
Thanks for having me. Doing fine.
Yeah, man. Good to have you on here. So we're going to get started with 10 questions requiring a little bit more of a thoughtful response and end with 10 rapid fire questions. You ready to get going?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. So you heard the intro about you, but of course we cannot do it justice in one opening statement. So tell us something real about you that the audience doesn't know.
Sure. So I used to live in Baghdad, Iraq, and I was not in the military and I was not a government contractor. I get that a lot.
Wow. What were you doing in Baghdad?
So that was kind of my first real job, if you will. After college, I worked for an economic development firm that sort of specialized in working in distressed areas. And my main job was to really kind of manage the operations there and oversee contract management, if you will, and helping projects move along from start to finish. And I learned a lot. It was a lot of fun. And that's really more of my interest in finance and financial services really was born.
Okay, and how long were you there for?
Well, I worked for the company for about 3 years. I was in the country for about 18 months. And during that time, I got to travel quite a bit to Istanbul, Turkey. We had a regional office there. Amman, Jordan, Kuwait, even some. But I worked for the company for about 3 years. I was in the country about a year and a half.
Wow. So this set you up, I would imagine, for just a whole new view on life, I would imagine, coming back to the States.
Absolutely, and it has helped shape so much of the last. I mean, I came back to the States in 2012, I think. No, 2013, beginning of 2013. And I'm sorry, it was 2012. And since then, the last 5 years, I would say that my time in the Middle East has really shaped how I approach so many things today here back in the States. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of them later on. But yeah. Just living in a different culture, not only a different political culture, different religious culture, different financial and economic culture, has given me a really interesting perspective on how we operate here in the West and specifically here in America.
Yeah. Now, we talk to a lot of different people, and travel is one of the biggest things is feedback is like you just said, experiencing different cultures. And you went to the extreme of it, I would imagine, you know, being in Baghdad and the different areas you visit. So that's pretty amazing. Now, going into the work that you do day to day here at CasSource, what is your focus and what is the ultimate goal for yourself?
My focus is on financial advisors. I was with Big Wirehouse Merrill Lynch for a couple of years, and that was what I did when I came back from the Middle East. And so financial advisors are who I like to work with. I speak their lingo. I understand what they do on a daily basis, what their struggles are. And so I like working with financial advisors because it's just a good natural fit for me given my background. And so my ultimate goal is to be able to get to the point in business where I can do the things that I love, which include helping financial advisors, but also pursue my other passions, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a little bit. But that's my focus, is going after finding financial advisors that have obviously a need, an obvious need rather, for our services and the products we offer through CASSource, and helping them find business opportunities that they didn't know that they had within their book.
Yeah, and we see it a lot. Obviously, we do a lot of insurance planning for these financial advisors, but something that I've noticed that you do quite a bit is you have a way of helping the advisor out, whether it's a high-end advisor or a young advisor or, you know, whatever level they're at. You have a way of, you know, kind of giving them different ideas that really don't impact you directly revenue-wise, but you're building these long-term relationships with them, you know, whether it's just a small tactic that they can utilize or different things to think about. I would imagine that's something you're conscious of. You're just trying to do the right thing by people.
Absolutely, and I'm very much a people person. I'm Southern, so, you know, family life and friendships and relationships are important to us. So I try to do right by everybody that's in my network. And in the end, it does benefit you. I think as a business person, to help others out. I mean, just this week, I've had a great meeting that came all of a sudden from one of my longtime networking partners, who I've given a lot of referrals to and haven't gotten a whole lot back from, but he wants to do a lot of business for his new book of business with his clients. He's a financial advisor, and you know, it does turn around, but that is absolutely true. I love helping people. I love helping advisors think about how they can do different marketing, new products they might be able to offer, a new way of approaching an old school or an old problem, a new way of solving it. I like helping financial advisors succeed in their business. Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense, and we see it every day. So a lot of what you're talking about is what you are passionate about, and you mentioned it before. Now, removing everything that you do for CASSource in your business, what is your passion?
Sure. So it all kind of centers around my family. I have a very close, tight-knit family, and I have two brothers and a sister. I have seven nieces and nephews, mother and father. All of them live here in the Charleston area. And we're very much a politically engaged family in some respects. For the most part, it's that we're trying to get politics and government out of our lives in some respects. I love doing stuff with my family, and I love politics. And so those are my two biggest passions in life that I do outside of what I do at CASSource.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of what you're doing is you've come up and you've, like you said, you've been in Baghdad, you've been in two different major businesses, and you have a political background, like you said. We're going to touch on that here in a little bit. And all of that, there's a lot of marketing that revolves around everything that you're doing, whether it is business or it is politics. And for someone that, you know, came out of, what year did you graduate college?
2010.
So someone who's, you know, you've been in the center of social media, at least in your adult life. You know, I'm not sure about your teenage years per se, but like, what is your perspective today on social media?
Sure. So I can tie a lot of this, what I've learned the last 5 years, back to my time in the Middle East, because again, social media there in the Middle East is different. It's at a different life point, life cycle there. So my take is that social media marketing and marketing in general has to continue to change and evolve, just like in any business cycle. Any firm, any company is going to have to change their products or their sources or their prices or whatever to continue to adapt to the market. But at the end of the day, the goal should be still the same. And so, you know, specifically maybe email marketing, I see email marketing as a way of enhancing and not replacing old school marketing. In other words, just take a look at what email marketing is today. It is nothing other than postcard campaigns that are cheaper and faster.
Yeah.
You know, that's good, bad, or indifferent. That's the truth. If you look at a typical email marketing campaign, it looks very similar in so many respects to an old school postcard campaign. You have pictures, you've got product ideas, contact information, and you've got sort of a mini sales pitch all built into an email, which is exactly what life insurance agents did 30 years ago. So it is a way to enhance and not necessarily to replace, because the goal, the end goal, again, is the same. Whether you want to call it marketing, networking, business development, the end goal is to make a sale and to sell the product or service that you're doing. And so I see it like, you know, social media marketing as a tool to enhance other ways of getting your message out.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And that same goes for what, if you're using a network, say Facebook, you know, or Instagram, or any of these different platforms that exist today, or the ones that will exist in the future, it's a door opener, right? To those, to the end result that you're looking for, to build a relationship and who knows, possibly sell a product. And yeah.
Right. And what's interesting to me is that I've seen a number of folks in the millennial generation coming up in our business, in our industry, that seem to think, and to no fault of their own, that they seem to be under the impression that email marketing and social media marketing actually brings people to them and they don't have to make the sales calls. You know, I cut my teeth at Merrill Lynch making 200 cold calls a day. I always try to work this into a story. 47 and 203, those are my numbers. One day I was calling 401k plans and I got through 46 of them and they were all no's. And by the time I got to 47, I knew that this guy was, whoever I was going to talk to on the phone next, was probably going to reject me. But it ended up turning into a sale, and that was number 47. So that 47 was always, will always stick out in my mind. And then 203, I made 203 cold calls in one work day a few weeks after that, because I had the momentum. Now, email marketing, social media marketing, all of that is great if I'm still making calls, if I'm still reaching out to people. You know, a postcard campaign doesn't do you any good to send out or spend several hundred dollars or several thousand dollars on postcards if you don't reach out to all the people that you send the postcard to. Same way, same idea applies to social media and email marketing. If I reach out to 50 people on LinkedIn and I don't try and call or email or follow up or set an appointment with any of them, I'm probably not going to benefit. And I certainly saw that even in the political world, even running for a political campaign, that was true.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So it is, it's the passive selling can get in the way of the actual selling.
Yes.
So passive is great, and it allows people that you otherwise wouldn't have been introduced to. Now you have that introduction, you have a way to understand what they're all about, what their interests are, and now you can take them to that next step, which is engaging that relationship and taking it further and seeing where that might lead. So no, I agree with that. It's good viewpoints that you bring from someone who, like you said, graduated college within the last 10 years. So you just started going down that path and you were talking about running a political campaign. And as we mentioned early on, I got to ask, what was it like running for state senate, going door to door, selling yourself to the people of South Carolina, especially knowing that you were running up against an incumbent who had been in the position for so many years? And chances are, I would imagine you probably knew or thought at some point that the odds of winning were low. And how, what was that like? And then how do you tie it into what you're doing today?
Sure. So in a word, it was daunting. I had no idea. I had some idea of what it would be like legally and sort of logistically to run a campaign, but there's so many things you have to do to file with the State Ethics Commission, to file a statement of candidacy, and so there's a lot of paperwork, we might even call it red tape, in order to do it. And then there's reporting of every activity that you do. Every donation, whether it be a dollar or whether it be a Coca-Cola, that's a donation in kind, and that has to be reported. So there, logistically, there was a lot of that, and it was extremely daunting. I had really very little understanding of what that was going to be like, and it was basically like starting a business from scratch. I had to find employees. In other words, I had to find volunteers. I had to find revenue, or in this case, I had to find donations. I had to find a market, or in this case, I had to find the people that were in my district that I was running for. And I had to go to door to door, literally. I would do a lot of door knocking, I would do a lot of calling, and I had to take my idea and sell it to the people in the district. Now that's a very capitalistic way of describing it, but that's very much, again, a part of my my learning experience and my life experience the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years has been to understand how markets work and how business works and what it means to offer yourself as a product or a service. And so it was extremely daunting. I was going up against someone who had been there for 19 years and never had one opponent in those 19 years.
Wow.
And so the odds of winning were absolutely low. But tying that back in to my life experience, when I was in Baghdad, I became very good friends with two people who are now the Prime Minister and the Speaker of Parliament. And they would tell me how jealous they were that I was an American, not because of, you know, the financial markets, not because of all of our great stuff that we have, but that anybody, as long as they were a natural born citizen, could run for president. And it baffled me at first because I didn't quite understand that. But in Iraq, by law, the president is always a Kurdish person. The prime minister is always, by law, a Shia Muslim, and the Speaker of Parliament is always a Sunni Muslim. So if you're a Christian or small minority of Jews in that country, you'll never achieve one of those. If you're a Sunni but you're but not an Arab, you can't become the president, right? So it dawned on me that they completely have this very restrictive way of regulating the market. And so here, I think that we take that for granted a lot, and I tie this to the business world. We have a very small number of people that run for political office every year in the United States. And in my experience in business, there are a very small number of people that actually go out and make sales. The financial advisors that I work with, it's the same way. There's a huge opportunity, but few people capitalize on it. And I see that both. I've seen it in the political world. And so I knew that there was an opportunity to run. The odds of winning were, in fact, low. But one of my first days at Merrill Lynch, I remember a quote that we got from Babe Ruth, and he said, "Every strike brings me one step closer to a home run." Well, I decided several years ago that I really like hitting home runs, and I want to hit more home runs, so I'm going to swing the bat. And when I ran up against this 19-year incumbent, I saw it as an opportunity to swing the bat, just like I see opportunities to swing the bat every day in business. My odds may be higher or lower in some days over others, but as long as I can swing the bat, I'm going to do it because I want to hit a home run. And there's no other way you can do it unless you swing the bat.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know. And you're taking chances, and we love that. You know, but you're taking calculated chances, and you're doing it ethically, but you are taking chances and putting yourself out there. You know, this podcast is a great example of that. You know, we're going to put this podcast out, and some people aren't going to listen. Some people are, and some people aren't going to like it. That's just the way it goes. But we can't be thinking about the people that won't like it. We want to swing the bat and put it in front of the people that will, and then can create and can develop some value out of it. And,
right.
You know, to you, as a young man going out there and running for state senate, like, how are you not going to look at that as an incredible experience that you went through? And so someone can say different about it, but you had that experience, and you will always have that experience.
Absolutely. And I can say that, you know, a lot of political pundits out there talk about this, that, and the other. Well, I actually put my hat in the ring, and
that's right.
I may have lost, but it was a great ride.
That's right. And you're going to continue to do that in your sales career, and you're going to help other advisors do that same thing. So, and a lot of that, you know, goes back to what you've learned and what you've experienced, and part of that is your education. And with education, there's a lot of talk right now, as we know, how education isn't working, college is expensive, all that. Now, someone who's recently, not recently out of school, but close enough, talk about your college education and how it readied you, or perhaps didn't ready you, for the real world.
Sure. Yeah, we talk about it in a lot of circles, in political spheres, in financial markets. We talk about the cost of education as well, and in the workforce. You know, my college experience was fun, to say the least, and I'm of the opinion that a college experience should be fun. Just like I wouldn't want to hire somebody that hated their job, we shouldn't encourage our young folks, and I'm certain glad I wasn't. We shouldn't encourage high school seniors to go study somewhere that they're going to hate and simply go for the purpose of getting a piece of paper. It should be an enjoyable experience. And so to that end, it did ready me for the real world, because I learned how to make good decisions as a young man in college. You know, I had a lot of fun, and I spent a lot of time and built great relationships. But I also learned that there are consequences to my actions. Now, in terms of formal education, I received a degree in liberal arts, and I wanted to do that because I wanted to learn how to read and write and communicate effectively. I didn't want to be a communications major because, you know, at my school, that basically means you're studying mass communications and you're reading things, books that no one ever heard about or cared about, right? Yeah. But as a liberal arts student, I got to read a bunch of different stuff. Like I got to read, you know, books written by politicians as well as stuff written by Plato, and I got to compare and contrast how they communicated. And so that was pretty cool. And I wanted to be able to – I knew that in life, if I wanted to be an effective leader and eventually a manager of others and be able to – in business, be able to succeed, I knew that I had to be able to think well on my feet. And my training as a liberal arts student absolutely has applied, has given me great dividends as a result. It's prepared me well to think on my feet. There are other aspects that it didn't really ready me for the real world, especially in the business world. I would say that for the most part, getting a liberal arts degree doesn't give you any practical sales experience. That being said, I'm not sure what kind of a degree would.
Yeah, an internship within a degree, possibly, right?
Yes, absolutely. Now, I did have the chance to do that. And so I interned for a law firm. I think it was my junior year of college. And mainly what the purpose of the internship was to show me how a law firm works and how they go about getting clients. And so what I got to see firsthand was how let's take, for instance, the lawyer I worked for was a personal injury lawyer in California, how they went about finding new clients. And so that, absolutely, the internship showed me what sales was like, albeit in a different industry, but it showed me how, you know, specifically this businessman has a product, has a service. Here's how he goes out to find new clients and new opportunities.
Yeah. So you take your experience, or you take your education, apply it to the real world through an internship or through something, putting yourself out there. I think that's something a lot of people can do in college today. And you can also make a living, whether it might be just for grades, an internship, or you can actually make money. We have an intern, as you know, here, John, who was featured on an earlier podcast. And, you know, not only is it working, helping him out, but he's also making money for it. So, you know, it's a double win. So, you know, yeah. I think that's very important. Now, as we talk about, you know, kids in college and talk about the millennial generation, you know, want to get into a little bit about creating a legacy and insurance. And it's something that isn't often talked about, obviously, for the millennials, you know, 18 or teenagers and 20 something year olds. But what we are starting to see a lot of is these GoFundMe accounts being established. And, you know, really want your take on the millennial generation and whether or not you think they're taking advantage of acquiring, say, life and disability insurance at a young age, thus setting themselves up with a safety net at such a low cost today. Do you think they're taking advantage of it? Where is their mind at around this for someone that's involved in, you know, and has many people, colleagues, associates in that generation?
Right. So I think the answer in short is no. I don't think they're taking advantage of it. And there are probably 100 reasons why, but I think mostly it's due to the fact that we as an industry, financial services and an insurance industry, have not focused on the millennial generation in recent years, at least. Now, in the last maybe 18 months, we've seen a lot of wirehouse firms. We've seen a lot of or at least we've seen several insurance carriers come out with some marketing products specifically geared towards the millennial generation, but that to me is a sign that in the past, let's say 15 years, mainstream financial services and insurance industry has not focused on marketing to the millennial generation. So I think in short, the answer is no, they're not capitalizing on it. One of the reasons is because that we haven't done a good job of going after them and educating them well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would agree with that. So if and one of the reasons they're not, I would say, for I'm speaking for the industry, is they're not making a lot of money, right? They don't, the millennials, let's say, they haven't built up a nest egg. They don't have to protect certain things, or at least that's what they feel. But if you're playing the long game, which you and I talk about all the time, we're not building this business to be successful this second, right? You want to be successful today, but you also want to build it for the future, 5, 10, 20 years down the road. If you get in with the 20-something-year-old today, well, in 20 years, they're going to be 40-something. In 40 years, they're going to be 60-something. And you're trying to build out that legacy for them. Speak on that for a little bit. I mean, do you think that would... do you think that's a good approach to go after, you know, the 20-something or the teenagers at some point, right?
Sure. So yes, absolutely. Merrill Lynch, when I was at Merrill, we would get these sales reports and new sales ideas all the time. And one of them stuck out to me. There was only a 30% success rate among Merrill Lynch advisors. This was back in 2014, so the numbers may be a little bit different. But in 2014, only 30% of inherited assets were kept at the firm. In other words, 70% of the time, if a Merrill Lynch advisor has a long-term, long-time client who dies, their account is passed to the children, and the children don't do business at Merrill Lynch. Mm-hmm. And that's an astonishing number. I mean, think about building a book of business and having clientele for, let's say, 20 years, and then losing all of that business because the sons and daughters decide they don't want it, you know? So that to me is an astonishing number, which shows that we don't do a good job of going after the millennial generation. Absolutely should, because I mean, I'm a millennial. I can speak to this. We're the next generation. There are more millennials in the United States than baby boomers, and baby boomers were thought to be for a while to be the biggest generation. That's not true.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're not all. It's not only talking to the millennial generation about acquiring their own insurance or financial service, right? We're talking about now their parents or their grandparents. They're inheriting their money. Right, their estates, mm-hmm. and those individuals are taking their money elsewhere because they have no relationship with the advisor that
was there. Exactly, and it comes down to the relationship. You're right.
Yeah, and they're not walking in, so that advisor's not walking in with, say, $1 million check for a life insurance policy they own. Which, if they had done that, well, then they'd have the opportunity to then be, not say the hero, you know what I'm getting at though, to be the trusted person to say, "Wow, you really looked after my father or my grandfather or my grandmother, and I want to talk to you further about what we're going to do with that money."
Right. And GoFundMe, you mentioned GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. GoFundMe and other services and products out there in the market like that, they continue to be successful because the millennial generation, in my opinion, more than the baby boomers, wants to have their cake and eat it too. They want to do things themselves. And I applaud that as an entrepreneur. I'm an entrepreneur myself. I like doing a lot of things myself, changing my own oil in my truck. But the downside, or we might say the shadow side, of being self-reliant is that where we have a trusted advisor, we don't capitalize on that. Now, I've learned in the past few years not to do my own taxes because it's too much work, and it's much easier and probably cheaper in the long run for me to pay my accountant to file my taxes for me. But there are plenty of folks in my situation that would rather do their own tax returns themselves. And again, I applaud the entrepreneurship, but as a trusted advisor, we can help them make good decisions and give them a little bit of freedom and leeway to do things on their own.
Yeah, no, you speak obviously very intelligently about this, and it goes back to what you had said before. How about you're making a difference not only with the individuals that you talk to, but with the community that you're in. And now to really drive into something that I know you care deeply about is Charleston, South Carolina. And I care deeply about it as well. As you know, I went to college there. I travel there often on business. I see you when I go there. I see my family. So I'm very familiar with the area and the history of the area. But as someone who lives there day to day and works there day to day, and you see all the changes and what's going on, What is it like with all the influx of new businesses to the Charleston market?
I would say it's frustratingly exciting.
Yeah, I like that.
So, and there, it's exciting because I love Charleston. This is my home. I was born, you know, 10 blocks away from where the Emanuel 9 shooting happened. Charleston runs deep in my veins. It's frustrating also because, like anybody that has a love for something, they don't want to see it change. And my love for Charleston, it gives me pains to see some things change in the city that I love so much. So it's both exciting and frustrating. And there's also other frustrations that come with it. I mean, growing pains are going to happen in any growth situation. I mean, you see that in Charlotte. There are growing pains. Charlotte's experiencing its own growing
Absolutely.
Pains now because of development. But we know that done well, it can provide a great benefit and opportunity for everybody there. So we've seen especially an influx of technology companies in the Charleston area. So much so that good, bad, or indifferent, the city of Charleston decided to set up a special fund of money and a channel through which technology companies can come to Charleston. And that, to me, is a sign that we're really on the brink of something new, something pretty, pretty significant. If taxpayer money is being set aside for something, that tells you that there's probably a market for it. So I'm very excited about the next 10 years of business, especially the tech business in Charleston, because it's just bringing a lot to it. It's not only bringing jobs, which everybody always can get behind and can love, and we like that, but it's also creating a culture of entrepreneurship in Charleston that I would argue has been here for a long time but has been dormant. There's a phrase in Charleston, old money, and that's probably a phrase elsewhere, but we use it a lot in Charleston. Much of what you see on the peninsula in Charleston was at one time owned by probably 20 or 30 different families, and that's it. Because they were very savvy, very smart, very wealthy, and they did well for themselves, and they made an investment. They embodied very much the values of entrepreneurship that we're seeing here again, and it's just kind of this new wave of entrepreneurs here in Charleston. We have, I think, something like 350 technology-related businesses, firms in Charleston now, whereas 10 years ago, it probably was a tenth of that size. And so that, to me, is just extremely exciting to see people that find an opportunity in the marketplace to offer a product or a service and to jump in and to do it. Yeah. And again, I love that partly because it's just who I am, but also because I've lived in a part of the world where that's not possible to be done. And so it absolutely encourages me to see people partaking in the market.
Yeah. No, we saw it with the conference we went to, not this past year, the year before, the Dig South conference.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're becoming like, these are the conferences they're doing in Silicon Valley, in Austin, Texas. And, you know, there's even articles being written about what you were just saying about the influx of tech jobs and tech companies to the Charleston area. So it's amazing what you see, and other people are taking notice. But what it does is, like you said, is the frustration of it is the infrastructure, which is the roads and the schools. You know, what is it like? What are the people saying as it relates to that? Because in Charlotte, one thing you do have is you have a lot of land. In Charleston, if you expand the road, you're going to end up in water, right? So how do we?
Yes.
How does Charleston handle that? Going
in some
forward?
Instances, the roads are already in the water.
That's right.
There's no silver bullet. I wish there were, but there's no silver bullet. We simply have to, in some instances, we have to buckle down, tighten our belts, and decide we're not going to spend money here so that we can use it there. But in other instances, we have to do a better job of planning. You know, Charleston is one of the few, let's call it, metropolitan areas of decent size in the Southeast that hasn't had a very good planning department in the last few years. One of the reasons why is because we have three different levels of getting a zoning change approved. We have the city planning department, we have the city Board of Zoning and Appeals, and then we have the County Board of Zoning and Appeals. And basically, you have to have two of three of those sign off on doing any kind of construction in the city of Charleston. And the city and county have recognized that is an impediment to the market economy. And so they are, I think, making good changes. But just talking about roads, I mean, we have too many people on our roads now. How accurate it is, I don't know. But the Department of Transportation for the state has said that it's going to cost us $2 billion a year just to fix the current roads, not even talking about adding new and additional roads to support the growth that we've seen. I mean, something like 60 people move to Charleston area every single day. That's going to be a lot of extra people, a lot of extra tires on the roads here, which means we've got to have new ones for them to drive back and forth to work and home and whatnot. So, again, there are going to be more growing pains. But like any good market economy, we will adapt as we grow because we like the growth and we want what it brings.
Right. Change is important. You know, sometimes change, like you said, sometimes change can be frustrating, but sometimes it can be exciting as well. You've experienced this yourself. And sure. As you know, we've experienced it even in our own company. We've developed a marketing company along on the insurance side, and we're developing a lot of content for other companies and also for ourselves. And as you know, within our content platform, sportsypreneur.com, we had an article titled, Making the Most of Change. And it looked actually at Lou Alcindor when he was at UCLA and when he developed the Skyhook. You know, they changed the rules, right. No more dunking. He had to adapt. And he created the Skyhook as a result, and the rest is history, right? So we have to make the most of change. And you personally had to adapt to change, maybe for some different reasons, but you went from being an advisor at Merrill Lynch to being more in the life insurance market at CasSource. So you've touched on this a little bit, but get more specific with it. What was it like making that change, and how easy is it for you, or was it for you, to adapt to your new role, and how would others perceive it to be, if others are considering doing the same type of thing?
Right. So one of them was a desired change. I had tried to do some insurance business at Merrill Lynch, and they wouldn't let me do it for a number of reasons. I had a two or three decent sized life insurance cases as the retail, the salesman, if you will, that were not approved by Merrill Lynch's the broker dealer, the Merrill Lynch, not the insurance department, but by the big wigs in New York for a number of reasons. And so one of those changes I made was desired, because I saw the need for life insurance, especially, and I've personally been able to help insure all the members of my immediate family. And so one of the changes I made was a desired change. The other one was really unexpected. I had spent, my days at Merrill Lynch cold calling 100, 200 people a day trying to sell them a stock. coming to Merrill Lynch, my focus has been talking to advisors. And so I've had to adapt to not being a retail stockbroker in becoming somewhat of a blend between an insurance wholesaler and kind of a risk management consultant or a marketing consultant. And so that's one adaptation that I've had to make, especially in the last 12 months, finding a niche for myself.
And you're speaking of, so when you went from Merrill Lynch over to CasSource, it was you had to become that insurance wholesaler broker, someone who was more helping the advisors, is what you're saying?
Yes, and my and even a different kind of wholesaler, because I had experience with wholesalers while at Merrill Lynch, but they were all from one carrier. Mm-hmm. Being independent here at CasSource means that I kind of have to fill the role of the carrier ambassador or wholesaler, if you will, which typically means coming up with product ideas or solutions to a certain problem that a client may face. But at the same time, I have to be entrepreneurial and maintain our independence, which we pride ourselves in being neutral in all respects except for the best interest or the best solution for the end client. So I have to balance both being sort of a wholesaler and calling on advisors, but also being willing to step into the role of being side by side with the advisor in facing their client. And my experience at Merrill Lynch was only the latter. I was only client facing. I didn't do any kind of broad B2B, if you will, business to business marketing. And so I've had to learn how to wear both of those hats to some extent. And that's a change that was not foreseen, but I think I've done fairly well.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about going from B2C in a way to going to B2B, but I think that plays to your advantage because we still do face the customer, right? We will go point of sale on the insurance side of things. But when you are going B2B, you are dealing with individuals. We actually had an article on our site about that, about how when you're in B2B, you're still just dealing with people. So in many respects, it still is B2C. It's just in a different way. And I think that that advantage you had of going and learning sales and dealing directly with the customer and understanding what it's like to be an advisor and then helping, and then in turn, a couple of years later, turn yourself around and now you're helping the advisor, but you've been in their shoes before, and that's an advantage that you have in that marketplace. And that's in many different industries, someone could play that out. So I think if anyone who's, you know, coming up and they're in a sales role and it's not for them in the long run and they want to make a move out, you know, there's so many different opportunities that are going to exist for them.
Absolutely.
So making that move is obviously it's a scary move, right? There's no two ways about it. And so looking at you today, what is the biggest fear you have in your business life?
I would say it's the things that I can't control. You know, I can control how many people I call a day. I can control how many meetings that I can drum up, or I can to some extent control the business that we get. But there are things outside of my control that I really don't like. I mean, last week, Mitch was on here talking about, he told this story about how this one of his very first clients, husband and wife, the husband had died, and he said he had done well in life, which meant he had an estate tax problem. And that was just kind of an eye-opener for me listening to the episode where Mitch is saying, your reward for working well and saving your money is that you have a tax problem. You know, those are things that are kind of beyond my purview of control. That those things fear that are the ones that I fear the most is that I may be able to work really hard and we may become very successful at CASSource, but something like that that we can't control, and you know, maybe it's a regulation or a law or something, or maybe it's a change from the insurance carrier side that we can't control that will completely alter the way that we have to do our business. So those are the things that I fear the most in business life. I know that if my back is up against the wall, that I can fight against whatever's coming at me, and if it's in my control, if I have the opportunity to swing the bat, then I know that I can be successful at some point.
Yeah.
But if the rules of the baseball game changed where instead of three strikes I only get two, now that's going to make me that's going to change the way that I approach batting.
Yeah, no, it changes everything. Well, and that's the entrepreneur mindset though, right?
Yes.
You have to be willing to take risk, and those things you talk about, the disruptions that could, and you know, quite frankly, they will happen, right? They're going
sure.
to be changes, and we've seen it all the time. But understanding that those changes are coming down, and you are so well spoken in many different areas, not that you're a master of different things, but you can speak on a lot of different topics. You have this thought leadership ability, whether it's the city of Charleston, whether it's politics, whether it's helping a business think of different ways to be successful. If the insurance industry got shut down tomorrow for whatever reason, you can pivot. And that's the thing that we talk to a lot of business owners about. Don't just think of yourself, yeah, obviously focus on your strengths, and we talk about that a lot too, but be able to pivot, because become a thought leader or whatever you want to call it to other areas in the likely event that some aspect of your business will change. And
absolutely.
But you're absolutely right too. I mean, there's no doubt it's a fear that many business owners have, so I think it's very respectable. And it's an honest, and the transparency that you bring to the table, I think is great. And like I said before, very well spoken in many different areas. That's going to appeal to a lot of people in the Charleston market. Or, as we know, a lot of people are traveling and going on vacation to the Charleston market, so they're all interested in it. So appreciate that. You gave a lot of great, thoughtful responses in the first part of this interview. Don't go anywhere, because we are going into some rapid-fire questions right after this message. We would like to take a quick moment to tell you about an organization we work closely with called RODS, which stands for Racing for Orphans with Down Syndrome. We are a proud supporter of RODS Racing. The RODS mission is to nurture a positive image of Down Syndrome, to promote awareness for the adoption of orphans with Down Syndrome, and by participating in organized athletic races and awareness events. Ultimately, the goal is to find homes for all orphans with Down Syndrome. Because of our relationship with the founder of RODS, Brady Murray, we are honored to be able to contribute our work in the area of marketing to create even more awareness around RODS and their mission, You can learn more about Rods at rods.org. So now we're going to move to the rapid fire round. So Sure. Now we're going to go a little bit quicker. You're the receiver. I'm the jugs machine. We're just going to fire them at you. So are you ready to go?
Bring it on.
All right, let's do it. So what book are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book called Capitalism and Freedom, written by Milton Friedman. He was a 20th century, probably one of the most influential economists of the 20th century, won the Nobel Prize. And this book is very well written, and I'm reading it in paperback. I like to have something in my hands, usually. I also have a Kindle, but I like to read stuff like this in my hands. And it's a very well-written book for people that know nothing about economics or capitalism or markets. So Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Friedman, and Excellent. Freedom.
Okay. What is your favorite social media network and why?
Well, LinkedIn definitely is. It's hard to call it a social media network sometimes because it's used for business purposes. But that's probably my favorite social media network.
Okay. And what's the social media app that you just do not get?
I do not get Snapchat.
We get that.
I do not get Snapchat. I love videos and YouTube just as much as the next guy, but the ones that go away after 30 seconds and you can't go back and look at them. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I gotcha. It's a very common answer, so we're going to have to do something about that. All right, what phone app that you have that the audience might not know about that's most important to you?
Probably
one that they know about.
No, the one that's most important to me is probably Pandora.
Yeah.
I'm in the car a lot, so I like having streaming music on my phone. And being able to switch back and forth on different channels is pretty cool.
So you like Pandora over Spotify?
I do.
Yeah.
It's just ease of use.
Yep.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay
ease of
that
use
song.
And I exactly.
Okay. I get it. So you're an entrepreneur, we talk about it. You have an incredible mindset as an entrepreneur. You've done different things, you've made changes. What's the one thing you would tell an up and coming entrepreneur to focus on?
Swinging the bat. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're trying to sell, who you're trying to sell it to. You know, there have been people that have been successful in business in creating a market unintentionally. You know, I think Walt Disney is an example of that. He thought that people would be willing to pay money to go to an entertainment world with themes of whatever you wanted. And his brother and several of his friends said, that's a crazy idea. But he tried his hand at it, and it turned out quite well for the Disney family and for all of us. So swinging the bat, you know, even when the count is 3-2 and you know a nasty curveball is coming, swing the bat. Otherwise, you won't hit a home run.
Yeah, that's it. Now, that story you learned about Walt Disney, is that something you learned in school? Is that from a book you read?
I did, because I learned it in school because as a matter of fact, because one of the vice presidents of Disney, and I went to school near Disney's headquarters.
What school did you go to? I don't think
Biola University. It's in the Los Angeles area.
Okay.
And one of the vice presidents of corporate came and spoke to a group of young leaders on campus and told us the story about that. And then he had this idea of buying this swampland in Florida, and everyone laughed, even the bank that loaned him the money. Yet 10 years later, he was the one laughing.
Yeah, amazing. Well, there it is, though, too. I mean, you hear something you learned in college some years ago, and it's working for you on this podcast today. So education's not all that bad, right?
Absolutely.
So tell us a personal story that got you where you are today.
So I have failed quite a bit. I have failed a number of times, even in my young entrepreneurial career. One of the times that I failed was when I interviewed for, I think, 4 different jobs. This was after coming back from Iraq, from Baghdad. I interviewed with 4 different firms, one of them being Merrill Lynch, and they all said no initially. And it was a huge setback for me. Merrill Lynch actually told me, we're probably not interested in hiring you for another 12 months. That was a failure in several respects. I turned that around and I went back to I went back to the firm and I convinced them to hire me. So that was pretty cool. And I was really down and out. I was really, really stressed and disappointed after all four of those firms told me, no, we're not going to hire you. But the one I wanted to go to the most was Merrill Lynch because of their training program. I knew that I would learn to be a good salesman and a good consultant at Merrill. I went back to them, and for some reason, they said yes the second time.
Yeah, so you go out and you make your own things happen.
Yeah, right? And it taught me, well, it, not only that, but it taught me to take rejection in stride. I mean, take failure in stride. I swing the bat a lot, and I strike out a lot. Even Reggie Jackson, one of the all-time home run leaders, is also one of the all-time strikeout leaders because he swung the bat. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, can't argue with it. So this is not an easy question, but just give something, whatever comes to mind. We talked about it a little bit, but what's the one thing the city of Charleston can do now that will help them in the next 10 years?
We can go ahead and build roads before we start doing development. That's my opinion. But I would say that we've done it backwards. We have been letting developments kind of grow up, and we've had to piecemeal makeshift roads around them, and that causes a lot of congestion, obviously. I'm not a huge fan of central planning, except on the local level, and I think we do need that in Charleston. If we would go ahead and build roads where we have projected new developments, it would help us out tremendously in the next 10 years because one, it'll ease traffic, but also it will give us some sort of sustainable idea of what growth will be like.
Okay, that makes a lot, and I agree with where your head's at on that. I mean, we see it, like you said before, in Charlotte quite a bit, and I travels to Charleston, definitely the infrastructure with the roads. You'd like to see them get ahead of it, but it's a hard game to play because they want to get the development, get the money in, but I would agree there. So now let's get into some of the good stuff, and I'm going to take a quick dig, but don't worry because my Buckeyes didn't show up against them either. But as an avid South Carolina Gamecock fan, what was it like watching the Clemson Tigers win the national championship last season?
It was bittersweet. It was bitter. Obviously, they are my arch rivals, and you know I could never, ever tolerate anyone from Clemson except when they give me a large fry. But it was sweet still for the state of South Carolina, because I think it shows what we've seen in our state for South Carolina football, meaning the state of South Carolina, over the last 10, 12 years. We have some serious athletes playing at these institutions. And so it was bittersweet, bitter because those are my arch rivals, but still sweet because I know that's going to draw attention to football in the state of South Carolina. And I'm excited about what's coming in the future.
Yeah, I get it. I agree. So you've been a South Carolina fan your whole life, born and raised?
Yes, absolutely.
Is your family South Carolina Gamecock fans?
Every single one of us.
There you go. So Saturday morning through Saturday night's a big deal in the Heath household, isn't it?
Absolutely, man. That is, you know, we are loud and wild and crazy going. If we're not at the game, we do try and make a couple of home games a year.
Yeah.
Saturdays at the Heath household.
Well, I'm assuming you guys are killing alligator, cooking alligator, and then watching the Gamecocks on TV, right? Maybe even
you're
playing the Florida Gators.
Right. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we cooked an alligator. I shot one in my parents' yard last year, and we fried it up.
So what was the gator doing? He just got lost a little bit?
Well, he was coming to die, apparently.
Okay, that was it. And you made sure that his dream came true. Okay.
Yes.
So on the Gamecocks this season, the SEC East, you know, they're probably back to more of an up and coming team, and you got the Gators and the Bulldogs in there. What do you think? What are the odds of the Gamecocks winning the SEC East this year?
Better than you might imagine, probably 65-70%. Here's the thing about the SEC, especially in the East, you're always only one game away from being at the top, and that's just because of the nature of the competition in the Southeastern Conference. And the ACC is coming along too, by the way. But in the SEC, you are always just one game away of being at the top. And so I think, honestly, we could go – I can see the Gamecocks going 7-0 at home. We've got a couple of tough games, Florida being one of them. But between the hedges, I think we can go 7-0 at home. And if we do that, then we're probably one win away from winning the East.
Yeah, and then playing Alabama probably, right?
Yep.
Okay. Makes sense. So I know the Southeast and South Carolina, it's big. It's college football. But the NFL's here too, right? You got the Carolina Panthers here, and I know you're a football fan, and we like to ask our guests for their Super Bowl prediction, which is perfect timing because the season's right around the corner. So we'll ask you now, who's going to win the Super Bowl this year?
I think my bet would be on the Carolina Panthers, honestly, because of one person, Cam Newton. I think that he has matured more in the last year than probably the previous three. And I think that's a sign that he is going to step into a new type of leadership role with the team. And that's going to be, I think, the impetus that Carolina needs to win the Super Bowl. And I want to see the Panthers win the Super Bowl. Not a huge NFL fan, but I do want to see the Panthers win the Super Bowl. So I think, honestly, they have the best shot.
I like it. Good call. So, Mark, it's been awesome having you on here, and I want to make sure that people can connect with you because, you know, there's a lot of questions people might have for you and all that. So what's the best way they can reach you, whether it's social, email, phone, whatever you like? Let them know.
I'd love talking on the phone. That's always easiest. I'd like that better than email, and my phone number is always on my LinkedIn page. So that's, again, my social media of choice is LinkedIn, Mark Robin Heath, and my contact info is always on there.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mark, for being on this podcast and taking the time to be on it.
My pleasure.
You have a great mindset when it comes to business, and personally, honestly, it's a great joy to watch you grow your business and build out the Charleston and the entire South Carolina market. So again, thank you for being on this podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mark, it was absolutely awesome having you on this podcast. For those that don't know, Mark is an indirect reason why this podcast is happening right now. From the revenue he brings into CadSource on a daily basis to his excitement about the changing business landscape, the work he does matters. And it allows CadSource to grow, which in turn spawns ideas like this podcast. The perspectives he brings to our business all the time and on this podcast specifically are now perspectives you as a business owner and entrepreneur can use for yourself. And for that, Mark, thank you. And for any business owner or entrepreneur that is having a tough time making changes in your business, I would encourage you to watch a person like Mark Heath. He is someone that made a career change and is now helping others grow their business. If you have questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can contact me on Twitter at Eric_Kaz or with the same name on Instagram, or you can find us at CazSource.com with links to us on the different social networks. Thank you for listening to our CazSource podcast, Entrepreneur Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time. And until next time, we're out of here.
A big thanks to Rods Racing for their support of this podcast and allowing us to contribute to their inspiring cause.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It's a big deal to us. We hope you found value in it. And if you did, we would be incredibly grateful if you gave us a review on iTunes. Remember to subscribe to this podcast and feel free to share it with anyone you know. More than anything, thank you again for listening. We appreciate it.